session number 30135, reel 5.
Fergus, can I ask you something about being a magician in camp?
Well, there's no doubt about it. It saved my life because I was able to do something with it. The Japanese camp commandant in the camp was a real devotee of magic. I've found this with all the Far Eastern people. They love magic. They really do. And he got me into his hut to do some magic for him. And I hadn't got anything in those days to do it with. But what I would do, I would borrow a coin off him and then vanish it. And he would have a tin of fish on his table. I would open the tin and get the coin out of it, which was good. But he then pushed the tin of fish over to me. They would not touch anything that we'd touched because we were verminous, you know. So I got a tin of fish. And then I remember doing a trick with a banana. I got him to take a card, and he took the four of hearts, I think it was, and I asked him to peel the banana, and it fell off in four pieces, and I got the banana. And then I would do tricks with cigarettes, and I got the cigarettes, tremendous currency, and I got any food I saw in the place, I would immediately do a trick with it, invented on the spot. And I could do magic with any food you can produce, because I ended up eating it. Well, the one day when I could have lost my head, he asked me to do a show for him one evening. He'd got some officers coming from another camp. And I said to him, "I'm sorry, I have nothing to do anything with." And he said, "You speak," which means, "Well, just say what you want." So I thought, right. I said, "An egg." That's a month's pay. An egg. So he got a little chitty out and wrote it, gave it to me, told me to take it to the Japanese cookhouse. And I went there and gave it to the Japanese cook sergeant, and he read it and asked me what I wanted. So quick up here, as all of us were, it can't say one egg, can it? Otherwise he wouldn't ask. What must it say? Perhaps it says give him what he asks for. So I said 50 eggs. So he got 50 eggs, 2 years' salary, and I went back to the hut and made a 50 egg omelette with our friends. But I wanted one proper egg to do the trick, but I wasn't going to waste it. So I cut a hole in the back of the egg with a needle made from bamboo and emptied that into the omelette as well, and then had to make an egg. So I picked a piece of kapok. There was a kapok tree there. I picked a piece of that off and dipped it in some red palm oil, and that went in for the yolk. A little bit of coconut oil for the albumin. Then I stuck the flap on again with paste I made from rice. And that night I did the trick, which ends up by you breaking the egg. And it all went very well. The next day I was summoned into the commandant's hut. And normally he was friendly with me. He would always, when I say friendly, he would always nod when I went in, which was like God being on your side. He'd just go like this. Well, I went in there, and he was just looking down. He didn't look up at all. So I stood there. I thought, what's going on? And I shuffled, and he didn't look up. I thought, my God. And I looked on his table. There was the chitty that he'd written out the day before. And I thought, I'm dead. And I remember thinking, when you're about to die, you like to do something before you die. And I thought, I've got to see something that I can look at. And the side of the hut was made of rice sacking, and I was looking at the weave of it, thinking, this is the last thing I'm ever going to see. And then he said, "You do trick with one egg." I said, "Hey, where 49 eggs. Off comes my head. Now, I'm not religious, but something came out of my mouth that I didn't know about. Out came these words. The show was so important for you, I was rehearsing all day long. And he went, now, to this day, I don't know whether he fell for it or he knew damn well what I'd done, but it would save his face for me to give him. But I walked out. Now, Russell Harty's show, we were asked to go up there, and he had been to the Imperial War Museum, and there'd been something on there about Far East prisoners of war, and he said, my God, I didn't realise what they put up with. I must do something about them. And he said to the powers that be there, got anyone with a story? Well, as soon as anyone says that, they send them straight down here. Absolutely. Right. And so we turned up, and it was in, I forget the name of the theatre, it's in the grounds of Guy's Hospital. There in a story in that, one of their students there eventually became a big name in surgery. He went to Australia, I think, and he sent money to build a new theatre. And they built a theatre, not an operating theatre. They got the message. So this theatre is in the grounds of Guy's.
Right.
And it was a live show, and I turned up at 5, I think the show went out at 6, met the other two, and with my little doggy, he always went everywhere with me, and they said, you can't have him on with you, he can't come in here, insurance purposes. I said, right, good night. He comes with me or I go home. Oh, all right then. So they let him come, and he sat in the wings while we went on. Now, Russell Harty came and introduced himself, and it was a live show, and he said, now you'll be sitting on this sofa, I'll be sitting there, you'll sit there, you'll sit there, and you'll sit there. Now then, he said, you've got an interesting story to tell about a code. I said, yes, I have. And you've also got a very interesting story about some magic with an egg. I said, yes. Right, he said, well, we've got a code on that black card, that's, they gave me that. But he said, we want you to do the trick. I said, there's no way I can do it. He said, well, why not? I said, the thought of it makes my knees go like jelly. And well, he said, we want you to do it. I said, I can't. I haven't done it for 40 years. I've got to remember the routine. And I'm shaking at the thought of how close I was to being dead through that trick. Anyway, I said, I haven't got an egg. So he said, well, go and get one then, you've got to do it. So I went out of the theatre with my doggy, 5:30 at night, to look for an egg. Now, where are you going to buy an egg? From down at London Bridge. And do you know where I walked to?
No.
Oxford Circus, from really? Down there.
Really?
What's the market in the back there?
Oh, I don't know.
The vegetable market, right the way up. Joins Oxford Circus and Piccadilly.
Covent Garden?
No, sorry. Anyway, it's
in
a plain market. And I got a box of eggs there. Now I have to walk back. It's an hour this was going to take. So I walked back with my eggs. And when I'm coming in the back door, which is onto the set practically, I hear them announcing us. By name, the three of us, and they played the Prisoner of War tune, you know, and they marched on. And I came through the door, and I took an egg out and threw the box at someone and marched in behind them. And my sister said, it looks as though it had been rehearsed for months, the way you all marched on. So I then had to do this trick. And I hadn't done it for 40 years. And I did it. And it laid them in the aisles. And so it's back in the business again. I do it again now. It's like the man with the bombing picture, you know.
Yes.
Have you shown you that yet, have I?
No, you haven't shown me that. Were there any other incidents when magic actually saved a situation or got you out of a sticky situation?
No, it never paid to try and get out of any sticky situation. It usually meant more trouble. But what it did do, when we were working on the railway in the full heat of the day, we used to get, every hour, we got 10 minutes off to drink something, and it used to be usually tea. Well, that is river water boiled up and a leaf thrown in. And that would be what you got 10 minutes every hour. And while we were doing that, I used to start doing tricks with stones or anything that was handy. And the Japs would, guards would, oh, more, you know. So I'd be doing more. And anything I could think of, I would do. And they didn't realise that sometimes that 10 minutes turned into 45 minutes.
That got you more rest.
And during that 45 minutes, my friends were pinching potatoes and things.
Yes.
So that did.
Diversionary tactics.
Yeah, and the other thing where it undoubtedly paid off, when we first arrived in Ban Pong, there were little girls sitting along the side of the road selling omelettes and things. They had a little frying pan and a charcoal stove, and they would mix it all up. These little girls, four or 5 years old, doing all this and giving you money and change. Mm. And they had a little basket full of eggs, and then you paid for them and you got an egg or an omelette, whatever. Of course, I hadn't got any money or anything. And I used to go to these girls and say, egg, no good. And she said, egg, okay. I said, no, no. And the egg had gone. And I would pass it back to my friend behind me. And the girl would say, egg, okay, egg, okay. I said, no, look. And I'd take another one, look. Gone, no good. And pass it back. And it got to the state where all the other girls wanted to come and watch these eggs vanishing that were no good. And I said, look, egg, no good.
Another one.
And so it definitely got me a lot of little extras.
Yes.
Which made all the difference in the world.
I bet. One question about the post-war years. You described how it was difficult when you first got home and that you couldn't begin to explain to people. And as far as work was concerned, did you have a job to go to?
No. I didn't have anything. I was on sick leave for a year. As I said before, I didn't want to work. Mm. I was so glad to be alive. Who wants money? Mm. You get your priorities right. Our priorities, all you need is warmth, a roof and something to eat. That's all. You don't need refrigerators, television sets, telephones, bicycles. You don't need it. So I would have been quite happy to live in a hut. My ambition for getting on with life, getting on in life to me was being alive. And it is to this day when I get up every morning, I think, oh, I'm lucky. My regiment's down to 26 people left alive. And I went out to Thailand a couple of years ago and I took photographs of 48 of my friends' graves, and there wasn't one of them over 22 years old. And I made up, because people say to me, because I have Japanese friends, I've learnt Japanese anyway, they said, don't you hate the Japs? And I said, no, of course I don't. I hate the war. If there'd been no war, I would never have seen a Jap. And I was talking to a Japanese girl about it recently. She said, isn't it terrible for you to talk to me as a Japanese person after all that? I said, you weren't alive for 60 years before any of this. You know, this happened 60 years ago. You weren't even born. Why should I hate you? Mm-hmm. So I've always said that I've got no time to hate people. Now, Charles Peel, the first time I met him after the war, I didn't realise that he and I were in the same camp together. We were both on television one night. I think the show was called Tonight. Mitchell Moore and that lot and Frank Boff. And one day they phoned me up at the college one afternoon.
Where you were working?
Yes, and said, we're trying to find some ex-prisoners of war who wouldn't mind going back to the River Kwai Bridge and shaking hands with their ex-guards. And what would you think about that? I said, I certainly wouldn't mind going back there and bearing the hatchet, but I don't think necessarily I would shake hands. But I've got nothing against it. So they said, well, can you come up then and be interviewed? I said, yes. When? They said, this evening. So I had to leave the college an hour early, went up there, and Frank Boff met me, took me up, and then there we were seated at a table, Charles Peel there and me here. And he was in a furious temper, Charles Peel, and they were saying to me, would you mind meeting Japanese again? I said, no, I wouldn't mind at all. I said, I've got no time to hate people. I'm alive and lucky. And if I'm going to spend the rest of my life hating people, I'll end up full of hatred myself. And Charles Peel pulled out a bundle of papers and said, what about all these atrocities and all the rest of it? He said, it's all very well said. And Frank Boff said to him, you can put all those papers away. We haven't come here for a dissertation. We've just come for your views. He said, well, his eyes were blazing. And I said, well, we've obviously got diametrically opposed views on this, you and I. But I said, all I know is this. We've both starved and we've both been slaves, so we're brothers. And from that moment on, he's been one of my best friends. Yeah. He got the message.
Yes.
And he told me he'd got a little holiday bungalow. Use it whenever you feel like, he said. Mm-hmm. So I've been in touch with him ever since.
Did you belong to any FIPO associations?
No, I didn't.
Was there a reason for that?
Yes, there was, in a way, because when it started, there was a chap who was running it, no names or pack drill, that I knew in the camps. And he was a sort of a racketeer type, and he was never on any hard work. He managed to do in camp jobs and being on the good things. And when this started, I got an invitation to go up. They were in off Victoria somewhere at the time, and Eaton Square, I think it was. And when I went there, he was at the steps greeting everybody. And I thought, oh, here we go again. There's another racket here somehow or the other. So I didn't bother to go. That's the only reason. I'd had enough of everything, really.
Yeah.
And I was quite happy getting on, living my little life, and not worrying. And I've made it my rule never to worry again or be frightened. I've had all the fright frightened out of me. And I'm frightened of no man on this earth or anything else. And I've got no time to worry. If I see something coming along that's going to be a worry, I turn away and let someone else worry. And when I retired, I had all my bills, whatever they were, utilities, transferred straight to direct debit. So I don't ever have a bill come through the door. And my credit card, when it came each month, I would pay it off that day. So I have nothing to worry about or to make me worry. If something looks as though it's going to, I move on. So I've lived such a plain, happy life with no worries anymore. And I haven't time. Titherington makes me sick. I mean, he's written a wonderful book, I suspect.
King Kiseki.
Yes. Beautiful. I've got an idea there's some ghostwriters floating around there, but it is a beautiful book. You've read it.
I have.
And he's done an awful lot for ex-prisoners of war. But to my mind, he's wasted his whole life since the war being bitter about the Japs and trying to squeeze money out of them, and all in a good cause. But I would just rather go and live and go for walks with my doggy, you know. Mm. And it's two different viewpoints, and I find that there's two types of ex-POWs. Those like myself who will talk about it, and others who don't want to ever speak about it.
So that's my last question, really. Do you feel that talking about your experiences has helped you?
Oh, yes. It's a funny thing. It's a sort of detached thing. But when I'm talking, I'm right back there on the day. And I've done these talks all over the country, Oxford University, everywhere, Tunbridge School 8 times. I was in Acton this week doing it. And I don't ever prepare a thing. It just bubbles out of my mouth like it's been doing today. I don't have to think. And if someone mentions something, it just comes back and I'm right there. And same with that massacre. I'm in that bed. I know where it is. And when I went out there recently with my son, I said, I'll take you into the ward where this happened and show you the bed I was in. They wouldn't let us in the hospital. I'm sorry, I can't come in. So it didn't happen. And when I, every night since the end of the war, I've had the most terrible nightmares. Every night. And of course, my wife used to wake me up. And then when she died, my doggie would wake me up. He'd lick my face until I woke up. Now he's gone. I have to see it through myself right from beginning to end. And each night when I go to bed, I think, well, I wonder which one it's going to be tonight. And I went out there 2 years ago with my son. And the day we landed in Singapore was the last time I had a nightmare. When I saw... There's no trace that there was ever a war here. So I'd expected to see bamboo and attap huts and things, and as it was, it didn't, as you know, it's such a beautiful place now. And it wiped, it switched off. So I haven't had a nightmare for 2 years now.
Well, Fergus, thank you so very much for sparing the time, and it's been absolutely fascinating listening to you.
It's unbelievable, really, isn't it, how you get away with it?
Luck.
Well, call it what you like, but I've got plenty of it. I must try and find you that photograph. The Japanese used to give us a wooden token, and we were then allowed to go out into the jungle alone and find firewood. And then when we came back, we had to hand in the token.
Yes.
And firewood was very hard to get, because green bamboo was no good, it wouldn't burn, you had to find dead bamboo somewhere, and it would take all day. And what I used to do was to get out early and get into the jungle and find my wood quota and bury it like a dog. And then I'd spend the rest of the day in the jungle on my own, looking at the creepy crawlies and the snakes and the lovely flowers and things like that. And one day I was lying, I came across a patch in the jungle with a lawn about the size of this room. It was just lovely green grass and hibiscus plants and things there. And I thought, right, I'll lie here for the rest of the day and pretend I'm home. And I did that. And while I was doing it, I suddenly heard voices. And I listened very carefully and discovered that they were English voices. So I thought, well, the war's over, because it sounds as though it's a radio or something. And what I was listening into was a test match between England and India. And I thought, where's it coming from? If I could find them, you know, perhaps I can get out. And I crawled around and found a cave. The entrance was a hole about that size. And I crept in to where these voices were, where this voice was. And inside there was a huge Buddha, all in gold, and the cave inside was huge, and sitting around in a circle were English officers.
Yes.
You know, I told you they didn't do much work. And standing there in front of them was a man giving a commentary on the cricket match between England and Australia of 1936, ball by ball. And they used to ask him, what would you like today? Well, Kent versus Sussex or whatever. And he could describe the day's play ball by ball. And it was E.W. Swanton.
Good.
He was a major in the artillery, sister regiment to ours. I didn't know at that time, but that's what he was. They used to sneak out and he would ask them what test match they wanted, then he would go through it ball by ball.
How extraordinary. Oh,
that's another of the coincidences. I remember one day there, seeing him sitting on the side of the road. Oh, that one. Colonel Tuesday.
Yeah. Good luck and many thanks for helping to amuse us.
Colonel well, Tuesday. He always said that.
Lieutenant Colonel R.A., commanding non Pladuk POW camp. Amazing.
He always said to me that it's fellows like you that keep us going. That's the Dutchman who looked after me and who did the picture behind you.
Bakker.
Pronounced Bakker. But that always used to make the English people laugh.
Indeed. That would be my husband.
The sketch was the day after the preceding sketch. I was sent down to work on the pill boxes for defence of the aerodrome at Ubon. We had to carry pieces of timber like the one drawn here.
Yes.
Bill Wilder did that.
Okay.
And so on and so on. So this is obviously, I think that was written probably the day before it all ended.